previously on Unsolved.
So you don't remember if he actually came in?
No, I don't.
Because one of the other sister said she remembers a man coming in her room.
Oh, then I think it would be Joe then.
It could be. But if you don't remember that...
No, I don't.
Today, Jennifer isn't sure whether the man she saw was Joe or someone else. But she's adamant about one thing. He came into the room in the middle of the night while she and Michelle were asleep.
I never believed the story that she wandered away and drowned. I mean, that's just very unrealistic.
For the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm criminal justice investigative reporter Gina Barton. This is season 2 of Unsolved, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail. Michelle's mother, Jan, couldn't stop replaying that night in her head, wishing she could go back and change things.
I always had regrets. I wish I never took her arms off of my neck and I went back in her bed and laid with her. I regret that, but I went through that with myself. If I never had taken my hands off of her and just slept in her bed with her, I was always trying to convince myself I only would have stayed in that room, somewhere in that room. That might not have happened, or I would have seen it.
After Michelle disappeared and was later found dead, Jennifer still had to stay in the same bedroom that she had once shared with Michelle. And her mother painted the walls. They used to be light blue. She changed them to lavender. And she was really hoping that by making that change and doing some new decorating, both she and Jennifer would be able to forget how scary it was that Jennifer saw the shadow of a man in their bedroom that night. It didn't really work. Jennifer told me recently that it was very creepy to have to stay in that bedroom after that point in time.
After she disappeared, I remained in the same bedroom, had the same bed, the same toys, the same bunk bed, everything. I remember I had a dog, and I would force the dog to be in the bed with me.
Jennifer didn't share her fears with her mom, and Jan didn't know how to talk to Jennifer or to Michelle's brother Christopher about what happened.
And I, as a mother, didn't know how to express myself to them and how to start a conversation about it. I, myself, either. Just never did talk about it.
Jan's husband, Mike, wasn't around much. Before Michelle died, he had a job that kept him out of town except for on the weekends. And he kept that same job even after she passed away.
I think Mike went right back to work. I went right back to being home alone again during the week, so I couldn't think about all my feelings and all that time because I had the kids to take care of again. So I had to go right back to what, and I tried going back to work part-time too, keep my mind off of it.
Christopher says he can't remember his dad ever talking about what happened to Michelle.
I think my dad really, he internalized a lot of things and he just kind of never talked about it, never said anything about it, and it was almost like that kind of never existed or never happened.
Jan says her relationship with Mike suffered a lot.
We didn't share our grieving with each other. We were pretty much each other doing our own grieving separately during this. There was no sharing of, I wasn't sharing it with him, and he wasn't sharing what his feelings were with me. There was just nothing there anymore.
It didn't help that Mike's brother thought Jan had something to do with Michelle's death. The police calling it an accident didn't do anything to change that.
Well, I know his brother put the idea in Mike's head that I sold Michelle for drugs. And he said, I don't know why. He said, I don't know why your wife is so thin and she manages to stay so thin. He always thought I was on drugs. And I never had touched anything, of course. But then it got my husband thinking that maybe I did as well. So my husband went with his brother. My husband wasn't real supportive of me at all throughout all this. It's kind of like we had our separate ways already.
Jan held on for 6 months, but on Jennifer's 5th birthday, something snapped.
I remember being around the table at my 5th birthday, and, we were doing the happy birthday song and candles and everything. And the next thing I know, my mom's not there. And I don't know where she went. And then she never came back. And, later on, my dad told me that she left because she just couldn't take it. And then I don't remember seeing my mom for many years after that.
Jan just had a really hard time with what happened to Michelle. She didn't think she could protect her kids. She didn't feel like she was getting the kind of support she needed from her husband. The police had kind of abandoned her and said Michelle's death was an accident. There was nothing else they could do. So she was in a really, really bad place at that time.
After Michelle went missing, my mom was very distant. Just not there. Obviously depressed. But of course, when I was four, I wouldn't know she was depressed. But she was just kind of glazed over and didn't really talk too much. Kind of secluded herself.
Jan didn't know where she was going. She just knew she had to get away. She got on the road and started driving. She hadn't gotten very far when the shifter in her car broke. She pulled over and had this idea that she was going to use a clothes hanger to try to fix it.
When I was working on that, someone along the road came over and asked if they could help me. It was a truck driver. And he seen what I was trying to do. He says, "How'd you know how to do that?" I said, "Well, I had to figure out something." He says, "You're the kind of girl that'd be handy." And we started talking for a little bit, and I told him where I was going. He says, "Well, you can park your car where I usually park my semi, and I'll be going to Colorado, and I don't use the cab up there. You can lay down during the day, and when I need it at night, you can sit in the seat. You don't have to worry about me trying anything on you, but it sounds like you're trying to get away for a little bit." He says, "I'm going to do that." So I went on the road with the truck driver, and I went to Colorado, I went to Florida. It was all over the place. Meanwhile, I didn't know. Mike had put out a missing person report on me, so the truck driver got really scared. He thought he was going to get arrested. I was gone for about a month.
Jan went back to Watertown and tried to work things out with Mike and take care of her kids. But she couldn't pull herself together. She started drinking. One night after she left the bar, she got into her car and swallowed a whole bottle of pills.
The police department showed up and got me to roll my window a little bit. They finally got in and got me. And last thing I remember, I must have nodded out. And I woke up in a nut house. I didn't know I had been sleeping for over a week. I asked them where my purse was, and they told me, and I looked in there. I seen my keys, and I had an idea where I was, and I walked as far as I walked, and I walked so far, and I finally found my car, and I got in, and I went back home to see my kids. I decided to see if I could make it work with Mike again. And then we stayed together a couple more, I'd say another 3 more years again. I just had to call it in after that. Just wasn't working.
Jan and Mike eventually got divorced.
Losing our daughter just put that much more of a damper on our marriage. It's just, either you stick it together or you don't. We didn't.
Do you think you would have stayed together had that not happened?
I can't say. I've heard a lot of people that have gone through this. When they lose a child that way, you stay together, you don't.
Jan moved out and left Watertown.
And my mother slowly kind of worked her way to Illinois. She started moving to Johnson's Creek for a while. And so she wasn't too far at first. And then she kind of, she lived there for at least a year, I don't know exactly how long, but for a while. And then she started to move, and she finally ended up in Carpentersville, Illinois.
Jan didn't even try to get custody of Christopher and Jennifer.
I never wanted to go to court and fight for them, because Mike said if I ever went to court with him to try to fight for the kids, he'd win them anyhow on me. Because of what happened with Michelle under my care. And I didn't want to go through all that again. So I felt there's no sense in trying. I'll be doomed anyhow. So I thought, well, maybe they're better off, safer with him than they were with me. I just want them to be safe.
Mike still didn't change jobs. After Jan left, he was out of town just as much as before. He rented out the top floor of his duplex and gave the tenants a discount on their rent to take care of the kids, who at that time were still in elementary school.
Over the years, there'd be different babysitters that would come in that had different parenting styles, and some were more attentive than others. Some would actually come down and wake us up, get us dressed, feed us breakfast. You know, we get home from school, check on us, do homework. But other babysitters were not as attentive. They literally maybe would come down once a day at nighttime. We had this Chinese couple that taught us how to play the piano, and they were very loving. And I don't remember them having kids. I think it was just a single couple. But they actually were nice and came and cooked us dinner. We had this Baptist family that was there, and they had I think it was a little boy, the father would take you into the bedroom if you were bad. I don't remember what I was bad for, but he would spank me. And then after he'd spank me, he'd read the Bible with me.
And I just feel like it's so sad all around. I mean, it's sad for this mother who lost her daughter. It's sad for her other kids who lost their mother. And I'm sure that anybody who has kids would like to think that they would stick around and pull it together and step it up because of their other kids. And Jan told me she tried to do that, but she just couldn't. And I mean, I can't blame her for that. And Jennifer and Christopher don't really blame her for that either. They've kind of made peace with what happened with their mother and the fact that she wasn't in their life for a long time.
I still care about my mom. I still love my mom, you know? I wouldn't say I don't, like, hold any ill will towards her for leaving. It's just, it's kind of like it is what it is, and that's what she had to do.
I think now that I'm older, I can say that I'm glad that I did stay with my father, and that I think he was the more stable person of the two and the more able to take care of us out of the two. But at the time, I really, you know, I wanted to be with her more, and I really did miss her through the childhood. I think with my father, you know, I think I knew that he had to work to provide, and, you know, I mean, I wish he could have been around a little bit more, but I think it was something that we were used to.
After a few years, Mike remarried and had another child, and his new wife was there to take care of all the kids. Even though Jennifer and Christopher didn't like her at first, they eventually all got used to each other. Jennifer and Christopher have been really resilient through this whole thing. I met Jennifer, and I was just kind of surprised that she wasn't a mess. She's beautiful. She's got a great career. She's married. She's helping raise her stepkids. She's articulate and smart and has it all together. And I honestly have no idea how she managed to get herself to that place. And Christopher, too. He went in the military. He got out. He got married. He's a dad. They're just living pretty normal, happy lives. And to have gone through such horrible things when you were a kid and to come out okay on the other side is just really impressive to me and gives me hope for a lot of the other people that I've talked with and interviewed who have been through such awful things.
I mean, I do think we have a very strong family. You know, we might have had our struggles and stuff like that, but ultimately, I mean, I don't want people to have the perception that my family's a hot mess or anything. We're still very close. You know, I'm still very close to my siblings and my stepmom. I'm not as close to my mom, but if she calls me, I'll answer the phone.
Even after Jan left her home and left her other kids, she remained obsessed about Michelle and what had happened to her. And so periodically she would call the Watertown Police Department and ask what they were doing. Was the case still open? Did they have any leads on who might have taken Michelle? Usually she didn't get any answers. And then finally she reached the police chief in Watertown, Richard Reynolds, and asked him if the case was still open. He told me he doesn't remember this conversation, but she says he told her no, and he said, "You should be happy we found her. You don't have to worry about her anymore."
Yeah, I remember him basically saying pretty much that the case is that she had wandered down the river, fell in, and the case is pretty much closed. Be thankful that we found her, so you wouldn't have to be worrying about her being out there all that time, wondering if she's still dead or alive. Be thankful that we found her. I couldn't accept. I went and got a Milwaukee telephone book, and I started going under private investigators. And I was going backwards because there were so many the other way, so I thought I'd go backwards on through them and see what they would cost or to hire and get different prices, because I couldn't accept what I was given. And a lot of them were either too high or out of my reach, so I kept trying for some reason. I don't know why. And then I finally come across this here Kraszewski guy.
Norbert Kraszewski started out as an investigator for an insurance company. After more than 10 years of doing that, he became a private detective and started his own agency. And at one point he had almost a dozen employees, so it was not a small-time thing. He was pretty legit. At the same time, a lot of people in law enforcement did not care for him. And I'm not sure if it was his personality or that he was just really aggressive. Those are some of the things I've heard. And in fact, the State Department of Justice did a background investigation of him once he got involved in the case, which I found pretty interesting. Essentially, it showed that some of the police departments who had worked with him in the past found him annoying and found that him getting involved in cases, using the media to try to get clues, kind of got everybody riled up but didn't actually accomplish anything. But not everyone thought that. Richard Perkins, who was the district attorney at the time, really liked Kraszewski. And the two of them agreed that there was more to Michelle's case.
The sheriff's department wanted to call it an accidental death. And both Kraszewski and I were concerned that accidental death could not be used as simply a default category for unsolved causes of death. In other words, you didn't just rule the death accidental because you had no other solution for it.
Kraszewski at the time told a newspaper reporter that his usual rate for a case like this would be about $150,000. But in the cases of missing kids, he would work for free or at a greatly discounted rate, kind of like his donation to charity. And what he told Jan was that he would take her case for free and she would only have to pay his expenses if any came up. Jan told me the explanation for that was that he had already been kind of working on the case of Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew, the teenage couple that had disappeared from the same area. So he was already familiar with Jefferson County. He kind of already had a little interest in what was going on there. And then at the same time, he just had a whole lot of sympathy for the parents of missing and murdered kids. Kraszewski's first move was to go through the one-year-old case file about Michelle's case. And one of the tips that he found in there was that some waitresses in Black Earth, Wisconsin, which is about 70 miles from Watertown, had seen Michelle in a restaurant during the time she was missing. And there was nothing in the file to indicate that that had been followed up on. Krzyzewski died in 2008. His agency no longer exists, so I couldn't find his files. But while he was working on Michelle's case, he wrote some letters to Orville Kwame, the Watertown detective. Some of those letters ended up in the stack of records I got from the Department of Justice. Detective Kwame filled in some of the blanks for me.
Norbert had apparently come across these women from Black Earth that allegedly had seen Michelle in a restaurant there with an older couple. The day following her abduction, or right around that same day she was reported abducted, or the day after. And they were strangers, and so they reported this occurrence. Norbert was very interested in that.
So I decided to go to Black Earth to see if I could find those witnesses. Back when Michelle disappeared, they were working at a restaurant called the Black Earth Cafe. It's closed now, but the building is still there. Black Earth is actually kind of a lot like Watertown. It's a small, kind of insular town. It used to be more booming with more jobs and more economic growth going on, but now it's kind of more like a bedroom community. And it totally had that small town feel. When Katie, my producer, and I were standing outside the cafe waiting for the owner to let us in, a woman came by and asked us if we were planning to buy it. Just because they're not used to seeing strangers standing around outside like people would be in bigger cities.
You have the feeling people are wondering who we are.
Yeah. I get the feeling that every single person who walks by is like, who are those people?
We don't know them.
Vern Wendt was the owner of the building, and he gave us a tour.
They used to cook breakfast out here, and then there was the kitchen was way back. They started doing lunch, you know, when they were cooking breakfast out here, the lunch person was out there. So
is it just breakfast and lunch, or dinner too?
Well, depending on who was in here, but most of the time it was just breakfast and lunch.
And when we walked into that cafe, although a few things had changed and there had been an addition put on, the main dining room was pretty much the same as it had been in the 1980s. And you could really get a sense of this small town community, this cozy restaurant, and how strange it would be for these waitresses to think that maybe there had been kidnappers in there.
In most of these little hometown cafes like this, you've got the regulars that come every day. They don't miss. If something, they don't show up, somebody's calling them and saying, are you okay? Or you tell them the day before, I'm going on vacation or something.
So they don't worry.
Yeah.
Vern remembered a lot. But he didn't remember the names of the waitresses who said they'd seen Michelle. So we headed to the police station, where Officer James Cartman had gotten out some boxes from the 80s for us to dig through.
The only file that I briefly looked through was this one here.
Okay.
Which says complaint forms from that year.
Okay.
And I mean, there's stuff with that officer's name on it. So I mean, we're in the right time period. Mm-hmm.
Sitting on the other side of Officer Cartman's desk and searching through the files, it became clear pretty quickly that Black Earth doesn't have much of a crime problem. For most of the time we were there, Officer Cartman was on the phone with a man whose neighbor had been complaining about his dogs.
All right, so you have to put yourself in her shoes. It doesn't matter if it's a matter of minutes that they leave your yard. It only takes, you know, 5 seconds for them to bite her. So if she's fearful for her life because your dogs are running over into her yard.
Eventually, we found what we were looking for. In a document dated October 21, 1981, Officer Bob Schuyler wrote that two waitresses came to the police department and told him they believed they had seen Michelle Manders on October 16th, 2 days after she was reported missing. The document says, quote, Watertown detectives notified. They said they would come to Black Earth to interview the two women. The people we talked to in Black Earth said Bob Schuyler had left the department several years ago. They thought he was still alive, but I couldn't find him anywhere. It took a while, but I tracked down two of the waitresses, Rosie Schulting and Donna Sutcliffe. They both remembered seeing a blonde-haired girl who seemed familiar to them, and she was with a middle-aged couple. Rosie told me the way the couple was acting seemed off to her.
But, you know, we were busy. And I noticed them sitting down at the booth, and they put the little girl in a high chair. And something just wasn't right. You know, you get that feeling with the two, because she just didn't look like the motherly type, and nor did he look like a fatherly type.
Donna remembers the little girl fussing. When kids would do that in the restaurant, one of the waitresses would bring them some ice cream to help them calm down. But in this case, the couple wouldn't let the little girl have any.
If they were grandparents to this little girl, I don't believe in public that any grandparent would treat the grandchild the way they treated her. To me, it looked like they were treating her anyway. And it was not respectful, because they were very rough with her. That they were not you might say they were not kind to her. They would pull on her, and if she wanted something to eat, they'd just slap her hand and say, "No, we'll give you what you're going to eat."
Both of the waitresses remember the woman took the little girl to the bathroom, and they could hear the little girl screaming through the door. But when they came out, she was strangely calm.
And then when she came out, she was almost like she was limp. You know, I don't know if you'd say she gave her a shot or something to make her quiet or what. I don't know, but she just didn't seem like the same girl. Now, that makes any sense of what I'm saying, but that's about what we thought about it anyway, because we all talked about it. Even after they left, we were concerned about it. Because it bothered us terrible. We talked about it for days afterwards.
Five days later, one of the waitresses saw Michelle's picture in the newspaper, and that's when it clicked that she was the little girl they had seen in the cafe. Rosie still remembers that very clearly.
I mean, I knew she looked, the little girl looked so familiar. I know, I thought, but I just couldn't, and then we were so busy, but I kept looking at her again. Where did I see you? And figured it out a little bit too late. But there's just absolutely no question in my mind it was her.
Donna couldn't stop thinking about it either.
Working at the restaurant, that is the first time that ever happened down there. That being a small town, you think you would see more things like that, but that happened, but it didn't. And it was spooky. We all had the creeps. And the owner, when she came back, we told her about it right away, and she was the one that said that we should tell somebody about it, because she was kind of concerned about it too.
After they told Officer Schuyler, he called the Watertown Police Department. And then he told the waitresses that somebody working on Michelle's case would be coming to talk to them.
In fact, I was supposed to go down to East Dubuque because we were doing some things with my mother's estate. And he asked me to stay here because someone was coming that wanted to talk to us, all three of us, so would I stay in Black Earth. So I said, sure. So, but no one ever did show up. They didn't come.
The waitresses who I talked to couldn't really figure out why nobody would come to talk to them. And I couldn't figure that out either. The only theory that I have is that a lot of times in missing persons cases, cases involving missing kids, the police just get dozens and hundreds and so many of these tips that it gets overwhelming. I don't know if that happened in this case or not, since I don't have the entire file, but that's one thing that could have happened. Still, though, I would think if you've got one cop calling another cop and saying, hey, I think this is credible, I think they actually saw her, it seems like that would be something they'd follow up on. I asked Detective Kwame why they didn't.
We didn't feel that there was any reason to explore that. Okay. There was, you know, this sighting, but it just was not, I don't know, it just wasn't something that would float your boat, you know, not something that would jump up and say, oh, this is it, you know, we got to do this. It was, somewhat ambiguous, I guess, it just didn't seem to build the interest that you might be on a good, solid lead.
Bob Schuyler, the Watertown police officer, said that wasn't his understanding at all. He thought it was a valid lead. He thought it would be followed up on. I couldn't reach Bob Schuyler, but what he told a newspaper reporter at the time was that he was just puzzled by the lack of initiative on the part of the investigators on Michelle's case. And he said he just wanted an explanation of why they didn't show up, but probably any explanation they gave wouldn't be good enough. The incident still haunts the women who were in the cafe that day.
Well, it was heartbreaking because we knew something was wrong, but what can you do? You can't do that much of, when you don't know for sure, you can't do that much of, you try to help a little kid like that as much as you'd like to. And I mean, we did what we could do, but and that we couldn't do anything else.
But there was one person who wasn't going to give up on this clue, the private detective. Next time on Unsolved.
As you know, it took Terry Mueller over a year to come forward with information. 5 minutes after she let Michelle Manders out of the back door of the Manders residence, a mystery vehicle pulled into the driveway and sat there for several minutes with its headlights on and motor running.
They talked about hypnotizing you, but you don't remember.
I don't remember if they did or not, but they're talking about it. I said, okay, I'll go for it. And then Joe said, don't let him do it. I said, why not?
What did he say when you said why not?
He said, I probably won't live. That's what he said.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail. Support our independent investigative work by subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find the latest offers at jsonline.com/subscribe. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. Unsolved is reported by me, Gina Barton, and produced by Katie O'Connell. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, photos by Mark Hoffman, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Lou Saldivar and Bill Schultz. Our copy editor was Debbie Davis, with social media outreach by Emily Risto. Andrew Malika worked on interactive graphics. The news reports you heard in this episode came from WISC TV News 3 and WMTV NBC 15, both in Madison.